From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, it's time for our monthly science roundtable, and our connection this hour certainly is timely. It was made just 1 week ago when Vice President Joe Biden joined a long list of local leaders in announcing a new photonics institute in Rochester. AIM Photonics, Advanced Institute in Manufacturing Photonics, is part of a plan to harness this technology. And if you're still not sure what photonics is exactly, our panel can help explain. And this being our monthly science roundtable, we'll talk about the science of photonics, or integrated photonics, especially, as we're going to hear. If you want to call the program this hour with comments or questions, we welcome you to do so. The number is 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. My guests for the hour include Rob Clark. He is the chairman of the AIM Photonics Board of Directors, the dean of the Hagem School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at the University of Rochester. Rob, it's great to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also here is Duncan Moore, professor of optics and the vice provost of entrepreneurship at the University of Rochester. Duncan, nice to have you.
Great to be back.
Ryan Raffelli is the VP of research at RIT and associate provost. And nice to have you, Ryan.
Thanks, Evan.
And here is Mike Mandina. He's the president of OptiMax and the chair of FAME, the Finger Lakes Advanced Manufacturing Enterprise. 24 years of OptiMax, a great story there. We're going to be talking about that, and it's great to have you here as well, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
All right, Rob Clark, let me start with you. Congresswoman Louise Slaughter, 1 week ago today, compares this moment to the 1960s, when Xerox expanded substantially, adding thousands of jobs in Rochester with a forward-looking technology. Do you view this the same way?
I do. I've been talking to a number of the members of the Institute of Optics, and I think when you think about the tradition of optics here in Rochester, from the great companies to the formation of the Institute itself, it's likely the most transformative commitment to this area in all of its existence.
Wow. Well, let me go ahead and read an email from a listener, and this will help us start to roll out the question on what the science is and some of the terminology, which I think is, again, still, it can be confusing, certainly to me. But Jim writes to the program this morning, Evan, thanks for your monthly science roundtables, and today I hope you won't be shy in the science portion. Your listeners can handle it. Trust us. We would like to hear a thorough explanation of how photonics works, and you might start with the difference between optics and photonics. Just a thought. Maybe a false premise we're going to find out. Let's go around the table. Rob, I'll start with you. Optics and photonics?
Well, that's why we brought Duncan along. But I think the real question is the difference between integrated photonics and photonics. And maybe I'll let Duncan just give a quick summary.
All right,
on that.
Duncan?
Well, I don't really see a difference between optics and photonics as the words. The photonics is a made-up word to be compared to electronics, which was generated about 20, 30 years ago. Before that, it was all of optics. And so some people back in that period decided that they wanted a unique name that separated what they were doing from some of the traditional optics that we're famous for here in Rochester area. So some people believe photonics is a subset of optics. Some people believe optics is a subset of photonics. So there's no general definition of the two. So I just use the definition. It's the generation, transmission, and receiving and sensing of light as both of the definitions.
Okay. So if you use them interchangeably, that's fine.
That's fine.
That's fine. The more important question, Ryan Raffelli, I guess, is the difference between photonics and integrated photonics, yes?
Yes. So if we think about traditional microelectronics, you know, the mantra of the 70s, 80s, 90s, smaller, cheaper, faster, better, and Moore's law for computing. And so we kept pushing the envelope on miniaturization of microelectronics. And when you start making those little metal traces, you know, those little wires within these integrated circuits smaller and smaller and smaller, well, the heat of the current running in those wires becomes a real problem. It's just like a filament in an incandescent light bulb, right? Eventually, the thing is gone. So the promise of integrated photonics is instead of using electrons and electrical currents running through those circuits, we're going to do it with light. We're going to do it with photons. So we're going to have little lasers and detectors and waveguides, because the light can convey more information with faster and a lot less heat being generated. So that's the promise of integrated photonics.
It's basic mathematics versus advanced mathematics, photonics versus integrated photonics?
Yeah, photonics is, you know, like Duncan mentioned, that's light. You know, everything from cameras to projectors and what have you. This is more akin to sort of the microelectronic chips that are in your cell phone or your computer or in all your home electronics and making those better. And we're going to do so through the use of light.
Okay. Duncan, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, I think, and it also includes things like how do you actually couple light together? So, for example, in fiber optic connectors. And we've got these huge data centers around the country that are generating or using a tremendous amount of power just to keep them cool. And so the whole hope of this is if you do it with light, as Ryan said, then you're not going to generate this heat, which means you're going to save energy.
Okay. Well, I'd like Mike Mandina to tell a little bit of the story of OptiMax, if you don't mind, Mike, because I read the story on the Democrat and Chronicle, and others have reported on the work that you and your company have done. And I think it's a very interesting story that goes back to 91, when the world was a little different on the technological front of this. So can you give us a little bit of the background?
You know, I think the thing about OptiMax, which is really relevant to our discussion today, is that I look back and the at the University of Rochester was the Center for Optics Manufacturing back in the, I believe it was early 80s, and Duncan was intimate with that, so he'll know more of that specific history than I. Out of the Center for Optics Manufacturing came new manufacturing technology for essentially grinding and polishing and finishing and measuring optics. So the kind of optics, windows and mirrors and lenses and those types of things. And that technology, that work at the Center for Optics Manufacturing spawned a number of companies, and some of the smaller existing companies grew based on the benefit of that technology. And I like to point to OptiMax as one of those companies that benefited from the Center for Optics Manufacturing. We created that company with the intent of employing the technology that came out of the Center for Optics Manufacturing and bring it out to the industry, applying it, and then seeing if we could generate market space and get acceptance from the customer base. And at that time, we were, you know, basically from one employee back in 91 now to 270 employees.
So you started small, as small as you can be. What was it realistically in 1991? What was the risk involved that this could work, that this could grow?
Well, it was we bought these machines. Comp started initially with the machines called the OptiCam machine, which were high-precision generators, which from those precision grind, you can go directly to polishing, and this removes steps. There was less tooling, and you could do, at the time, there was also an initiative going on called concurrent engineering, in which designs and prototypes were being building simultaneously, so we can go to customers could go to market faster with their products. And so the timing of the these OptiCam machines was such that traditional optics, it might take anywhere from 10, 12, 14 weeks. We were providing optics in about 2 weeks using this technology, and that helped to generate our market space.
Does AIM Photonics impact OptiMax?
So, you know, when you talk about traditional optics, that's what OptiMax is. Mm-hmm. We are an example of a traditional optics company. We make the things that redirect photons, okay? And in terms of the machines and instruments that are going to be used in integrated photonics, we will be a significant player in providing the optics to those types of systems. These systems are likely to be developed and invented in our region based upon the center.
We're talking about photonics and integrated photonics, especially as part of our monthly science roundtable with our panel. And we had a number of questions come in online already, and I'm going to try to get to some of those. But I want to stick for a moment with a little bit more on the science aspect that so many of our listeners have asked us to talk about. So one of the common questions was essentially, what are you going to make now with this? I mean, you want to talk very, very sort of bluntly and simply, but using the science that you're describing now, what is going to be made here and how is it going to be done? And Ryan, I see you nodding. Let's start there. How would you answer that question?
Well, one thing is, remember this new AIM Photonics, this new institute, it's one of these NNMIs, you know, this National Network of Manufacturing Innovation. So to Mike's point, this is about really about manufacturing. You know, a lot of the, you know, benchtop discoveries in integrated photonics have been made. You know, this is work that's been going on for literally decades. But it's now the point where, you know, no longer a laboratory curiosity. We want to get these out into commercial products. We want to be able to manufacture them at scale. So it's one thing to be able to attach one of those fiber optics that Duncan was talking about to a little chip. It's another thing to be able to do that in a, you know, 1,000 chips per hour kind of thing. And that's really what this institute is charged with enabling.
Okay, and we're probably, Rob Clark, a ways away from getting there. Everybody wants all these jobs tomorrow. They want all the space tomorrow. But what's a realistic timeline?
Well, you know, you ask what we're going to make. The first thing we're going to make are the tools that enable us to actually do the manufacturing. As Ryan pointed out, this has been largely based on prototypes, and prototypes don't give us the tools to automate manufacturing. So, you know, I would say between tool procurement as well as tool design and manufacturing, it could be 18 months to a couple of years really to get the tools in place to implement a proper manufacturing process. Our real outcome is the process itself. It's the you know, we have the fabrication tools in the foundry space in Albany at CNSE, so that already exists. But then, you know, once you start manufacturing chips, you have to basically develop the tools for packaging and assembly, which we're going to focus on here in Rochester. So, first and foremost, the Department of Defense, the focus of this this effort is to develop a sustainable manufacturing process. The reason Rochester was chosen and this whole team, it's a national effort, and the reason the whole team was chosen is because there is a belief that we will make this a sustainable manufacturing process. And to do that, it has to impact more than the Department of Defense interest. It has to actually have a significant impact on commercial infrastructure, because that's where you get scale, and that's where you basically make it cost-effective to go into a manufacturing process.
Jack writes to the program and wants to know why photons are more efficient than electrons. And someone want to jump there?
Well, they travel about 100 times faster.
Okay.
That's an important thing to do. And as Ryan said earlier, they don't generate heat. And so you don't have the cooling issue associated with it.
They don't have the electrical resistance of like an electron moving through a wire, right? So you don't get that, you know, heating that occurs.
And Jack wants to know if this puts electrons out of business.
I doubt it.
No. Why do you say that, Duncan?
Oh, I just think electrons are, they've been around a long time. They'll stick around a little bit longer.
But realistically, based on Jack's questions, how much, once we get up to speed, up to scale, we can manufacture, we can take the ideas that, the federal government released a video last week, about a 4-minute video that indicated that so much of what's going to happen here is kind of a clearinghouse for ideas that may come from around the country, sort of narrowing, choosing the best ones, and being able to produce here. I hope that's an accurate description. I see Ryan and Robert are nodding. But once we get to that point, how much of what is manufactured is going to be VHS versus beta and DVD players versus VHS? How much is, you said it's not going to put electrons out of business, Duncan, but are we moving in a way that will start to change a lot of
We certainly will, because you think about these data centers, it won't be cost effective to have a data center run on electrons. It just won't be. Yeah. They're just so huge. The other thing you need to think about is we're kind of at the point where we were when we still made transistors and resistors and capacitors, and you know, we put them all together, we packaged them. And then suddenly the integrated circuit came along, which allowed you to put everything together on one chip. And that was when you get economies of scale. You can start scaling things down. You make it a much cheaper process, because the whole issue of picking something up and putting something on a board, which was cost effective in the 60s, and when we had the early transistor radios, that was the best way to do it because it beat out vacuum tubes. And so we're trying to go through another generation of these things, and because the laser is only 50 years old. And so, you know, you think about what's happened with laser technology over that 50 years. And for the first 10 years, nobody could figure out anything to do with it. And so now it's ubiquitous in all of our devices.
So I think that's a great point. The VLSI, you know, the very large scale integration, instead of putting the semiconductors on the circuit, we're going to put the circuit on the semiconductor, right? That was the grand breakthrough, you know, smaller, cheaper, faster, better, to the whole next level. That's what we're trying to do with light here. As far as putting electrons out of business, to a large extent, what we're talking about are electron and photon interactions. So the way that light is going to interact with the electrons and the other pieces and parts of the of the system. So, no, they'll be working together. We're not putting them out of business. But the one point I'd make about Rochester in our role, as Rob talked about, you know, the packaging role, the one thing Rochester is really good about is making complete systems, you know, not just making the chip or making the laser or making the detector. You know, we've always prided ourselves on being a real manufacturing hub. We make real things. We take all of these pieces and parts and we put them together in real systems. And I'd like to think that that's going to continue as part of this institute.
Well, there's a term that Caleb on Twitter has said, here's a half serious question. He wants to know if and how photonics and lasers are related. The use of lasers?
Yeah, absolutely. So, in fact, that's going to be one of Rochester's big roles in the new institute. We'll be making the small little lasers that get integrated into these integrated photonic devices in Albany and CNSC and the big foundry there. So we'll be making the little, they're even smaller chips that will be manufactured here, sent there, integrated, and then they'll be sending those back to us for further packaging and integration.
Okay. Let me get a question on the there have been a lot of kind of comments and questions about work and who's going to work in this field. Mike wants to know, what kind of degree does someone need to work in photonics? It's a good question. Rob, where do we start with that?
I think there's a broad range of needs. I think, you know, one of the discussion points I think we've had with the initial members and the participants, since one of the exciting things about Rochester, I mean, certainly we don't have a background in manufacturing and integrated photonics here. By definition, the manufacturing processes don't exist, but we've had a significantly highly trained workforce for a long period of time. The kinds of skills that are required in precision engineering, you know, around optics, the traditional optics that you know, Mike mentioned, are going to be critical. You have to have a trained workforce who understands how to pay that a level of attention to detail. So I think we'll see everything from, you know, there'll be associate degree programs. You know, I think we'll really be able to leverage the community colleges. I think, you know, undergraduates in the engineering programs here and other parts of the state will come to get bear. And then, of course, we'll have our advanced degrees as well working in fundamental research. So I think it'll span a really broad spectrum.
And I think it's important to ask the folks from RIT and the University of Rochester how these institutions are preparing for a future of photonics as a hub here. Duncan, I'll start with you on that.
Well, since he's the dean, he commented to me, we're going to be looking for two new faculty members around this area, which I think will be very exciting. Those searches will start fairly soon. That'll be a great thing to have happen because we'll be able to bring some young faculty members to Rochester, presumably. And this center, because it's so large, and as Rob said, this is transformational. This is a once-in-a-generation type operation that we're actually going to be able to change the orientation of Rochester in a very significant way. And what Louis said last week is right. I mean, it's like the 60s. And so we've just got to make sure this all comes about. And the two universities are working together on this program, working with MCC. They've made a big commitment to optics also. And I think that's a really important thing. It's to Rob's point, there's probably going to be more jobs at the technician level than there are going to be at the PhD level. Yeah. I mean, we'll generate some PhDs, there's no doubt about that. But those will be measured in tens mm-hmm. of people. The technicians are going to be measured in hundreds of people. Yeah. And the one thing I would encourage all the listeners there, make sure that the kids take enough math. That is the real problem in some of these technical areas.
Ryan?
Yeah, that's exactly the number that popped in my head. You know, for every one PhD you hire, you're going to hire at least 10 technicians and other folks who'll be working in these manufacturing centers. But that is true, what Duncan said as well. Even for these technicians and these other manufacturing jobs, math is always going to be a prerequisite. So everybody needs to take their math. But I'd say at RIT, you know, obviously we're going to continue to still, just like U of R has the Institute of Optics, we have our Center for Imaging Science and our Microsystems Engineering programs and microelectronic programs. But in addition, there's going to be a lot of a sort of supplementary certificate programs and these sorts of things that we're developing as part of these institutes. So where somebody who may already be out working in industry can come back for some continuing education, more specifically geared towards the jobs and integrated photonics. So, you know, our Center for Electronic Manufacturing and Assembly, so more of the packaging end of things. And actually some of the, say, more traditional microelectronic kinds of experiences where they take you in the clean room and you really start to learn about working in that manufacturing environment.
And I could say that if the academic institutions were generating enough technicians, then the organization FAME wouldn't exist. So FAME exists because there is a lag in specifically technicians. It's much easier to find and hire an engineer than it is to find and hire a technician who are skilled in the discipline. And this is especially true in optics and photonics.
You're hearing Mike Mandina, who's not only the president of OptiMax, but the chair of FAME, the Finger Lakes Advanced Manufacturing Enterprise. And this is an important distinction right there that Mike's made. I want to ask Mike and Rob about this, because we heard Vice President Biden last week saying some very strong things that I wonder if the chair of AIM Photonics has now felt like they were appropriate, or do you feel there is a concern about overpromising? When the vice president says, you've heard of outsourcing, no more outsourcing, we're going to be insourcing. That's a strong comment, Rob, and we're talking about a lot of different jobs here. He talked about the brain drain, the so-called brain drain, the loss of intellectually trained students to go elsewhere to look for jobs. Is that an overpromise? What's going on with that, you think?
Well, I can tell you the Department of Defense reminded us at our first kickoff meeting that every dollar spent by the federal government on this program must be spent in the United States. So the whole purpose here is to basically build out the manufacturing capabilities in the U.S. It's not to subsidize research or the development of manufacturing outside of the U.S. It's about sustaining those capabilities here. So that wasn't an overpromise. That's a mandate by this program in particular.
When it comes to the jobs, you're hearing our panel say that don't feel like this is a PhD-centric kind of a job for the future. Not that there won't be some. But we're talking about technicians, we're talking about a lot of good-paying jobs that won't require a PhD, that RIT, that the University of Rochester are going to be training students for. Mike Mandina at OptiMax, 270 employees now?
Yeah.
What kind of, sort of training and background? Tell me a little bit more about the people who work for you.
Well, so many of our employees and our managers entered the workforce at OptiMax either with an associate's degree in a technology or generally, if we could find them, and generally we have to take less credentialed people, and we could probably qualify as a university with all the training that goes on in OptiMax in terms of bringing people in and having to teach not only, the art of optics manufacturing, but we run math classes, we do all kinds of other training, we associate the math with the technology and the instruments that we use in the workplace. For 270 employees, we have over 300 digital devices, many of which are computers. So people need to come in and understand Word, Excel, FileMaker. These are all the tech manufacturing jobs of the that this initiative is going to spawn are going to require people with technology type skill sets, where I think an associate's becomes almost a minimum in order to work and become a manufacturing worker.
The vice president talking about the brain drain, we hear that phrase a lot, Mike. Is it real here in Western New York?
Well, you know, I think we find that the brains end up, if you can get into take the associate's optics program at MCC, and if you can handle the math and the physics, the rigor is very high, and many of those students say, well, I might as well move on and just get my engineering degree. There's a 2+2 program with RIT and University of Rochester, and these kids move on, or there's some of them are adults. They move on into those programs, and very few actually come out into the workforce. It depends on their personal need in order to generate funds. A company like OptiMax, we've been desperate enough. We pay 100% tuition for our employees to get their associate's degree, and I'm always kind of set back on how few people take advantage of that. So, but it's required. So we, on our clock, we teach math, we teach physics add OptiMax to our workforce. And I prefer not to. I would wish our educational system took care of that, and we could hire people who had those that knowledge and skills.
Better math, for example? Better math? Is that where you're
math is huge. You know, yeah. I mean, you
But are students who are kind of coming into the workforce or headed towards OptiMax, are they undertrained in math?
In general, the answer is yes. Okay. And I think that's also the problem, frankly, if you talk to the folks at MCC or the colleges about the requisite skill that the students are coming in with, there's a lot of remedial work being done, especially in math.
Okay. Well, around the table then, I'm kind of building on those comments, the question of brain drain. Ryan, what do you make of it?
Well, I was reading out in the lobby earlier how Rochester was just recognized as the number one city in the country for jobs. And, you know, that's a great thing. You know, the economy is doing pretty well. We have a lot of jobs in Rochester. But on the other hand, I guess if those jobs were being readily filled, maybe we wouldn't be number one. So it's kind of a catch-22 there. I did like, Biden's remarks last week when he was talking about MCC and that Associates Optics program they have there. It really is a national model. And so there are some wonderful things already in place for us to build upon with this new institute. But that is one of the primary charges of this new institute is doing that building.
And Duncan, you were stressing math earlier. You're seeing the same sort of lacking sometimes?
Yeah, but I think in terms of the brain drain question, I think a plot that Rob put together several months ago, which showed the number of patents issued in this area over the last decade and the fraction of them that went to Kodak. So you go back 10 years, and I forgot the exact number, of that, but the Kodak part of the patent was about 80%. That number has gone almost to zero, but the total number of patents has actually doubled. And so more of the intellectual property now is in the hands of smaller companies, which is good for the diversification of this community. So people say, oh, all those Kodak people left, all those Xerox people left. Well, yeah, they're not in those jobs anymore. But we're still generating a lot of intellectual property in this community at a far higher rates than other places are.
And Rob, when we talk about smaller companies, OptiMax here, 270 employees. When we talk about a smaller company in general, what size are you thinking of?
Well, I think Rochester, we think about small to medium enterprises. They're in the hundreds to, you know, a few thousand employees, basically, until you get to the really large-scale companies. But you see a lot more small to medium enterprises throughout our nation than you see the mega companies anymore. And I think it's the agility that's required these days. If you look at how fast technology is moving, and this integrated photonics is going to be another perfect example of that, the only way to be agile is to basically come from a startup or be of a scale that allows you to incorporate a new technology pretty rapidly. And I think you'll see a lot more of that. That's why I think we're so fortunate that the epicenter is here in Rochester, is we're going to be right on the ground floor as this new technology is evolving, and with an opportunity for our small to medium enterprises to capitalize on that technology and integrate it directly into what they do and leverage it with other companies that come into the area.
Paul in Irondequoit's been waiting to jump on the program. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I'm a retired computer and electronics person, and this is very big for our community. I've even been following up on the internet and everything to see what's going on with it. And what these guys are telling you, it's not a one-time or a two-time change. This is exponential. And for the people that are able to get into this line of work, which a lot of people in Rochester will be able to, and with our graduating classes, this is a tremendous opportunity. I got into the computer industry when it was it was all retail. This was before the mouse was even online. And you can see where that's gone. There's a very good video on Gizmodo.com, and it tells you about the beauty of using light for communications. That's like the title of it. And it's from July 30th, and it gives a very good explanation of the way things are going. I see nothing but very, very good things coming out of this, and to comment on the rigorousness of the education involved, I don't want anybody to think that they can't accomplish this, because I didn't enter that industry till I was in my mid-40s after completing 2 years of college for an associate's degree and then continuing my education. And it reaches all people of all areas. There's people in Rochester that can do very well in this. So that's my comment, and I'd like to say thank you to the people involved for providing an explanation to the public. Thank you.
Paul, thank you very much. Some thoughts on the comments there. I think just a lot of nods around the table. Rob, you sum it up pretty well?
Well, I mean, this is an incredible opportunity for us. And as again, I think the federal government, when they came in, their number one priority is moving a manufacturing process forward that serves the Department of Defense needs. So they don't really talk about jobs. They talk about developing a sustainable manufacturing process. Obviously, lots of intellectual property, a lot of innovation that will result from it, and derivative jobs. The very same reason, OptiMax went from 1 to 270. There was a pretty good multiplier on that, right? So, and that was back in the day of the Center for Optical Manufacturing. And I think this is a much larger scale activity than that. But I think the point he made to the listeners out there is that it's never too late to go back to get retooled, augment your education and take on the opportunity.
I think that is an important point here, because every time we've talked about this, we've had questions on whether are these all going to be students who are in school now? Are there going to be retraining opportunities, particularly for people who sort of lost careers maybe in other local industries? And what you're saying, Rob, is there should be opportunities for retraining.
Absolutely.
Okay. And go ahead. I know Ryan and Mike want to jump in. Go ahead, Ryan.
I was going to jump in. We really haven't talked too much about the promise of this industry. The DOD, they are the procurement officials, and they have all of their own sort of needs and focus areas. But, the commercial projections on what the integrated photonics industry will be going forward is almost unbelievable. In the same way, if you think about the microelectronics industry and what that grew to be in our lifetime, the predictions are that this will be as big and most likely bigger than that. Keep in mind that this isn't just the U.S., right? This is a worldwide market, and the Europeans have made huge investments in this area, and they're running down that path. So have a lot of the Asian companies that have a lot, countries that have a lot to bear. But this is a wonderful example of the U.S. stepping up and saying, we're not going to concede this. We want to lead the world in this important new technology. And for us here in Rochester, it just so happens that they decided they want us leading the charge.
I was talking to Assemblymember Joe Morelli last week after this big announcement. And we talked about the fact that there might be a bit of a poignant irony, and I don't mean to oversimplify a narrative with Kodak, but Kodak made film, among other things, and held on a little bit long when it came to the digital turn, and I think in many ways was hurt by that. And now you're in Kodak's town saying, we are the ones looking ahead, getting ahead of the game, getting ahead of the world, and this is a chance to put manufacturing numbers higher than, back to very, very strong numbers. Not that they're not strong now, even though the sort of the landscape has changed, but there would be something kind of sweet about that, that says we're going to get ahead, that's going to be where Rochester is, and perhaps that would be true. But I think also, Ryan, it was big news last week, but it would be maybe easily digested if we were making Brownie cameras or copy machines or things that people can more easily talk about than photonics. You agree with that?
Yeah, it's a little bit more diverse when you talk about what the applications for these technologies are going to be: autonomous vehicles, future communication systems, all these LIDAR applications. So it's a little bit harder to condense down to a soundbite. But one thing to I think to put in perspective is one of the reasons why Rochester was chosen to sort of lead this for the nation is the legacy of Kodak and Xerox and Bausch and Lomb and Corning Rochester and all of these places. As Duncan mentioned, a lot of those white-collar scientists that maybe are no longer working for those big companies, they're still in Rochester. They're still cracking out patents, and they're working at places like OptiMax and others. And a big part of the request for proposals was talking about how are you going to incorporate all these small to medium businesses that Rob was talking about. We were lucky we had the Rochester Regional Photonics Cluster as part of our team. Sure, we have some big companies, Intels of the world and what have you, that are also on the team, but a whole host of small and medium companies who are also going to be participating in the effort.
And Mike, you wanted to weigh in as well?
Yeah, I just wanted the caller, I think, raised a real good point that is often overlooked, is that if someone gets an associate's degree, that, and as long as they're getting into it's been my experience, if they get into a technology growth area, it's a launch of a career. So if someone, well, I don't want to be a technician my whole life. You're not a technician your whole life if that's not what you want, but you are into an industry that's growing in an area now, a community, which we have significant investment going on. And so you will come up somewhere in a great job that's based on the photonics initiative that we've won. So, and it could be sales, it could be the accounting, but it's getting started. And I think that shouldn't be lost on people that they need to see the end game in order to take the first step.
We're going to get a short break in and come back and answer more of your questions that have come in online for our panel. It's our monthly science roundtable. You just heard Mike Mandina, the president of OptiMax, a company that began in 1991 with one employee, now 270 employees. He's also the chair of FAME, the Finger Lakes Advanced Manufacturing Enterprise. Also here, Ryan Raffelli, the VP of Research at RIT and associate provost as well. Duncan Moore is a professor of optics and the vice provost of entrepreneurship at the University of Rochester. And Rob Clark, the dean of the Hagem School of Engineering and Applied Scientists at the University of Rochester and chairman of the AIM Photonics Board of Directors. Your questions answered with our panel next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, the death of Cecil the Lion has led to a new conversation on big game hunting. And we're going to have a conversation with leaders of our local zoo who have been intensely involved in conservation efforts. They'll tell us about the facts regarding animals that are endangered around the world and what we all should know to try to make something good come out of Cecil the Lion's death. That's Tuesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Lucas Greenhouses in Fairport, serving the Rochester region for more than 30 years. The nursery offers locally grown plants, from annuals and perennials to vegetables and herbs. Lucas Greenhouses, grown right here. LucasGH.com.
Welcome back to Connections. It's our monthly science roundtable. You heard Vice President Biden talk about not just a four-year program, but also MCC, the work that community colleges have done. We know the Vice President has been a champion for community colleges and the work they can do on these scales. And so let me read Richard's question. It comes online. He says, please ask your guests about a photonics program that MCC offered over 20 years ago, a two-year degree program. How does it differ from what the discussion is centering on today? I worked with an individual that went back to school to MCC for this photonics program and encouraged me to get involved. Are they familiar with it?
Absolutely. And MCC is a partner on the proposal. They already have a fairly well-established curriculum, and so it's building upon that and sort of tweaking it perhaps for this some of these newer application areas. But yes, definitely part of the picture.
Okay, and that is just another part of the picture that is very collaborative. And Duncan Moore said during our brief break there here that we need to make sure we emphasize just how much collaboration is involved with this photonics effort.
Yeah, just within New York State, you have SUNY Poly, you have Alfred, you have Columbia University, then you have universities across the country, from MIT and Cambridge to Arizona, and big efforts in University of California, Santa Barbara, and Stanford. So we have a really high quality team working on this project, because it's a tough problem. There's no doubt about that.
Rob Clark is the chairman of the AIM Photonics Board of Directors, and I don't know how much you can tell us about just how much you knew over the last 6 months, because our understanding of the timeline was the January 3 finalists for this AIM, for the AIM Photonics Institute that Rochester ends up winning. And then what those factors were. When you're making presentations, when you're selling the Department of Defense, the federal government, and everyone involved that has to make a decision on where this should go. You have to have the scientific know-how, local institutions, a workforce, but infrastructure in space. What were the, you know, what were the points of emphasis, and was there ever a moment where you thought any of those single things was lacking, or can you give me a sense for what the last 6 months were like?
Any team that puts a proposal together remains forever paranoid because you're always hopeful and you're competing. And, you know, so there were three teams that were in the process. As far as us knowing where we stood in the process, there was essentially a cloak, you know what a cloak is, around that. So we really had no idea where we stood until the announcement came out. You know, a tremendous effort went into writing the proposal, and it was this distributed national team effort. And we would not have been successful had we not assembled that broad array of entities that included, order of 50 corporate partners as well. So it is a massively collaborative effort. The site visit that we had was we held that in Albany. We toured the fabrication facility there at that time. There was a lot of display in terms of how we would evolve the technology, how we would integrate it into the processes, and, you know, where we would set processes up, including here in Rochester. So tremendous effort. And then from that point forward, we had no idea other than the fact that there were the two other teams competing. I have to say, you know, I was optimistic. I mean, cautiously optimistic. I really felt like we had an outstanding team. I remember standing in front of our board of trustees at the University of Rochester, and they said, okay, give us some odds. What do you think? And I said, you know, I'd give us an 80-20. I think we're 80%. I think we've got a really strong team. And a couple of people were a little worried that I was quite that optimistic. But, you know, it is a strong team. We have a strong national presence. We have a great optics community here in Rochester, and a foundry just down the street. I mean, all the pieces are here. So very logical to me.
And when did you really know?
We knew when you knew.
You had to know a little
we
bit.
Knew it, we knew it was barely. It was barely. I mean, we were sworn to secrecy, but only a few days prior. Literally only a few days prior. I guess we knew when our senator released the information, which was
a little premature.
Well, perhaps, but you know, perhaps just got excited in the process as well. I mean, it is a great thing for the community, but literally that was the time frame when we were just beginning to find out ourselves, and the DOD really trying to keep that in stealth mode, if you will, until the announcement went out.
It had to be a special moment for you.
Oh, it was incredible. I didn't know when Ryan knew. I mean, we were kind of calling each other and not saying the answers. Ryan, do you know? Rob, do you know?
I know we're invited to this thing, and the vice president's coming.
Right.
So
you got to feel good about it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
He's not going to come and tell bad news.
That's right.
Let me also air one of the complaints. Well, actually, it's the only complaint I've seen, but here it is, and Deb wanted to raise her concern. She emails the program, and Deb in Brighton says, I'm concerned about what this means for quality of life of people living currently in Rochester. If the 7,000 new jobs, and I think we've heard 6,000, we can talk to Rob in a second about what projections are, but she says, if the 7,000 new jobs that are predicted in the next 5 years involve employing folks currently living in the area, that's fine. But if we're talking about a huge influx of population, I fear it would forever change the quality of life. Already there is so much new building, subdivisions, McMansions, and she's concerned about the impact and quality of life. So first of all, I don't know the number. She said 7,000. I've heard 6,000 as a projection short term. I don't know about long term. But I think what we're talking about today, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, is the idea that a lot of the people who will end up working in these jobs are here. Yes?
We have a lot of people here who will be, you know, part of the process going forward. I think I think we would be premature to focus on the exact number of jobs at this time.
Sure,
I mean, the real advantage is that this will bring intellectual property, innovation, and opportunity into our community. And I would say the number of jobs depend upon how hard we want to work for them. We can build as much as we can see in the future here, but those will be derivatives. It's not as if the DOD put the resources in place to create jobs. They put the resources in place to create the manufacturing base. And then it's up to our ingenuity, our innovation to really put those jobs.
Yeah, the other part of this is that the total workforce in the 9-county region is about 500,000 people. So this represents about 1%. And so we're likely to lose 1%, you know, over this period of time as gain 1%. So I think it's important to make sure that we understand this is bringing new technology. Hopefully it'll lead to better jobs, allowing our children to stay in Rochester when they finish. I mean, that's always an interesting thing is, you know, you want your kids to stay if they possibly can. If there are no jobs, they're out of here. So I think that's a bigger part.
And do we still don't know, there's still a lot that we don't know, right? Exactly the locations of where some of the manufacturing will happen. Joe Morelli telling us on this program last week that talk to us in a few months at least, maybe a little bit more, and then we'll get a better handle. Rob, on that?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of details to be sorted out. I mean, I've had, you know, myself, numerous phone calls and emails requesting information on how we can participate. You know, for example, you know, I've been looking on the web. Where's the information on the website? Well, we were just awarded, so we haven't even stood up a website yet. So there's a lot of fundamental infrastructure that has to be put in place before we can move to those points.
Different Jim writes to the program and wants to know how many local companies are already working and hiring in photonics right now. Any idea right now?
I mean, I think there's, Mike, 60-plus optics, small and medium enterprise companies
here. There's somewhere around 100 photonics companies already, you know, depending how you define photonics again. In the region, the photonics cluster has, I believe it's 70 members, and we have a very rich, diverse group of employers that are obviously already in the optics photonics area.
We mentioned earlier this hour that it was Congresswoman Louise Slaughter who compared this moment to the 1960s with Xerox significantly expanding, choosing to do that in Rochester. And some of the cynics last week said, well, look at Xerox now. And I took the point. I understand the point. You could look at Kodak and the vice president saying, this is them giving you the brownie camera and everything growing. And then the cynics said, well, look at Kodak now. And again, I take the point. I'd like to look at things in a positive light, but I want to ask the panel, when you look at the future of photonics, you can't know what you don't know, but what do you expect to be in terms of hurdles that would eventually injure or harm this community as a photonics producer? How do we stay competitive? How do we stay ahead? We're obviously already sort of leaping ahead of a lot of other communities, winning this this institute and trying to be a world leader, but how do we stay a world leader? I'll start with Rob Clark, go around the table.
We stay competitive by continuously reinventing ourselves. I tell our young engineers when they graduate from the university at this point, you know, you're probably going to work for 6 or 7 different employers. You're going to have to retool over the course of your career. Technology has moved and will continue to move at such a pace that we are going to continuously have to reinvent ourselves. The companies who survive are the ones who embrace change and basically look for ways to reinvent.
I agree with that. I mean, like human beings or any animal, companies aren't forever. I mean, some companies have been very successful in reinventing themselves. Corning be a beautiful example of that, starting with light bulbs and television tubes and Corningware and so forth through fiber optics. And so every 25 years or so, they've reinvented themselves and ditched the old technology. And so that's an example where it has worked successfully. But, you know, there are only a few companies that are over 100 years old. Now, we happen to have 2 of them here, and actually we have 3 of them because Xerox actually goes back to Haloid in 05, I think it was. So we've got 3 that have lasted over 100 years. That's really remarkable. But as we all get older, we get frailer at the end of things, and sometimes we're not able to survive.
Ryan Raffelli?
Yeah, so to the caller, I guess we can only guarantee a great next 100 years. After that, you know, no guarantees.
That's a pretty good deal, I think.
I would take it, but I think the reason why we had the Kodaks and the Xeroxes and Bausch & Lomb was all about innovation, and those that continue to innovate and reinvent themselves, those are the communities that prosper, and those that get calcified, which you could argue Rochester did to a certain extent, you suffer the consequences. So, you know, the jobs thing, you know, this is a big distributed team. So not every one of these jobs being created is actually going to be in downtown Rochester.
Right.
You know, they're going to be spread out amongst the team, especially in the early stages of the process. But to the extent we're successful with this, of course, we expect to grow and hopefully reverse any brain drain we've been seeing. Also, you know, the flight out of Rochester, the flight out of upstate New York. I mean, this is, we're talking about the partnership. I mean, this is a wonderful public-private partnership, too. I mean, the state has stepped in the way that few other states were willing to do in this large competition. You know, they stepped in, they made a major investment, they made it to Rochester, and so, you know, it's a great thing for our community that we hopefully will take advantage of.
And Mike Mandina, about 45 seconds, when you look ahead, how do we stay ahead here?
Well, you know, I have the position that I thought we were at risk with when we depended on Xerox and Kodak, because those are two firms that were monopolies. When they started up, they kept their monopoly mentality. They were not lean and innovative. They didn't have to be. And then when they needed to be to change the culture, the size, they couldn't do it. So I think this is great for Rochester. We're going to have diverse people with technologies and different companies, all small. It will be agile. And I think this is going to be very good when they write the history of Rochester 100 years from now.
Well said. A great panel this hour, exploring so many different parts of the photonics movement and the great success that Rochester had last week, and the hope that that translates going forward. And these are the people so involved in making that happen. Mike Mandina, president of Optimax, chair of FAME. Great to have you here, Mike. Thanks for taking the time. Ryan Raffelli, the VP of Research at RIT and Associate Provost. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Duncan Moore, a professor of optics and the Vice Provost of Entrepreneurship at the University of Rochester. Duncan, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Rob Clark, the Dean of the Hagem School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at the University of Rochester and Chairman of the AIM Photonics Board of Directors, who only found out when you and I did, when Charles Schumer's office put it out there. Hey, congratulations and thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
It's our monthly Science Roundtable. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you Tuesday on Connections.